is the quiet politics of Jesus. John is a longtime friend of the seminars. I recall that his first seminar at Westminster was in Advent. And though that was many years ago, I remember how perfect it was for the season. So we're grateful to welcome you back, John, in this most unusual Advent season. So let's get started.
Thank you, Sarah, and thanks to all of you who are present this morning for your flexibility as we live through this unusual time, this unusual Advent and Christmas. But I'm delighted that your seminars continue. I'm delighted that I continue to be a part of them. I don't remember, Sarah, quite how many years it's been now since that first seminar, but you've got a good memory that it was during Advent. And what we'll be doing over the next weeks, this week and the three following weeks, is around the theme of the politics of Jesus. But I've entitled it the quiet politics of Jesus, and you'll see why as we do some introduction to the theme this morning, the quiet politics of Jesus. So as we go along, feel free to put your questions into the chat box or to just interrupt me. That's fine, since I can't see you waving your hand. Or I will also leave some time at the end of the seminar for questions and discussion. Let's open our time this morning with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, you have welcomed us to this new day, to this Sunday, this Lord's Day, this day of worship and praise. And we give you thanks that you allow us to gather together, even in this electronic way, that we might ponder what you wish to say to us today, and that we might grow in our faith to you and our faithfulness to one another. All this we lift up to you in Christ's name, amen. All right, so I'm going to share my screen with you. And let's see if I can get this to go. Can everybody see that? Is it good? Okay, so the quiet politics of Jesus. Our sessions during this Advent are going to focus on the idea of Christ as the one who brings God's peaceable kingdom. We're going to look at the quiet politics of Jesus in terms of three quiet virtues, three quiet character traits of the Christian life that are exemplified in Jesus's very life. I'll be doing an introduction to those virtues today, and then in the following weeks, we will look at each one in particular. What do I mean by the quiet virtues of the Christian life? Well, I have three in mind in particular. The first is truth-telling, that Jesus's life is exemplified by a commitment to telling the truth. The second quiet virtue is that of caring, of reaching out to others, of caring for those who are in need and in distress. This also is exemplified in Jesus's life. And the third quiet virtue of the Christian life is what I'm calling dignity. Dignity as the capacity to determine one's life, an inner freedom, a capacity to retain one's sense of selfhood even under conditions of repression and sometimes persecution. So Jesus's politics often take these quiet forms. They are not forms of open protest. They are not forms of violent resistance. They are not forms of political demonstration, but they are these quiet virtues of the way he lives his everyday life, with a commitment to telling the truth, a commitment to caring for others, and a commitment to preserving his own dignity, his own inner freedom. Since this is going to be a quieter Advent for many of us and a quieter Christmas, and maybe we welcome some of that after a tumultuous year of protests in our own country and the tensions around the election, perhaps this is a good invitation to us to think about the ways in which we can quietly manifest the virtues that we find in Jesus Christ: truth-telling, caring, and dignity. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the American artist Edward Hicks. He did many versions of this theme, the Peaceable Kingdom. I think our own Carnegie Museum of Art has one of his paintings. But in any event, this vision that we often lift up during Advent and Christmas time of the day that God's kingdom will come, that there will finally be peace on earth, there will be reconciliation between humans and God, between humans and the creation, and among humans themselves. How we look forward to a day when there is no longer the violence and violent competition that so mars our world today, but we look forward to the kingdom that Christ initiates. Now, the reason that I've been thinking especially about this theme this year has to do with my own biography, and some of this I've shared with you in the past, but I will lift it up to you again. So part of what has interested me in this theme of the quiet politics of Jesus is my own biographical experience of living in political regimes that made democratic politics very difficult, if not impossible. And I'm not thinking about recent experience in the United States. I'm thinking about extreme forms of authoritarian governments. So in 1984 to 85, 35 years ago now, I had the unusual experience, with the help of the World Council of Churches, of living for 1 year in East Berlin, when it was still communist East Germany. And I was a student at the Lutheran Seminary in East Berlin, 1984 to 85. And that was a remarkable experience of trying to understand how Christians preserved their own integrity under the conditions of a communist government. The other experience that has shaped my way of thinking about the quiet politics of Jesus has to do with the sabbatical research and the sabbatical stays that I've had in Russia over the last 15 years, beginning in 2004 to 2005 in St. Petersburg, Russia, but then also later a year in Moscow, and 2 years ago, a year in a smaller provincial town about 400 miles outside of Russia. And there too, the challenge to Christians living under an authoritarian regime. In this case, not the totalitarianism of communism, but the authoritarianism of Vladimir Putin's government. What does it mean to be a Christian under those circumstances? What does it mean to work toward the peaceable kingdom when you live under a political regime that makes democratic politics difficult, if not impossible, where the options for open protest, demonstrations, all that we have taken for granted in our American situation, all of those options are no longer available to people. Now, as we think about those authoritarian regimes, whether communism or more recent manifestations of authoritarianism, often political scientists have said there are really only two options. Either you do protest openly and publicly and take the consequences, and of course the consequences are typically arrest and imprisonment, or you passively withdraw. Those seem to be the two options under authoritarian governments, either to openly resist and be crushed, to be sent to prison or a concentration camp, or on the other side, just to withdraw passively into a private sphere of one's own. What we're going to explore over the next weeks together is a third option, this option that I've called the quiet politics of Jesus. I want to argue that a person can make a political statement by the way they live their life, that there is an option between open opposition and passive withdrawal, and that when you live a life with a commitment to telling the truth and caring for others and maintaining your own dignity, that that itself is a form of political protest under the conditions of authoritarianism. It's a quiet form of protest. It doesn't draw a lot of attention. It's often without any kind of large public appearance, demonstration, spectacle. It's quiet, but it is a form of resistance. And under authoritarian governments, even the quiet politics of a Christian can be threatening. So it's certainly not passive withdrawal, but neither is it the kind of open, public, organized demonstrations and oppositions that we're more used to in a democratic situation. So when we think about authoritarian governments, we think especially about the disasters of the 20th century. We think about Adolf Hitler and fascism in Germany, the mass parades and demonstrations that provided a kind of ecstasy to people participating in some larger transcendent movement that bound them all together. And next to fascism, we think of communism, especially Stalin's communism in the Soviet Union. And the same kind of mass parades that brought people together to show their loyalty to the ideology of the ruling party. So these are very extreme forms of authoritarian governments. We call them totalitarian because they tried to reach into every area of life. They tried to impose their ideology in every area of society. So economic life had to run according to the party ideology. The arts, even hear this demonstration by sportsmen, everything to support and reinforce the party's understanding of reality. Science, even science we know in the Soviet Union was under the constraints of the party's ideology. It was the party that knew what was right and wrong. It was the party that determined the slogans and the party that determined what people should say publicly. And the party hoped that they would also internalize this ideology. the people would begin to practice self-censorship so that the ideology was so pervasive that people would police themselves. Now, of course, these totalitarian regimes maintained this ideological control with a vast network of spying, with the threat of harsh prison sentences, the concentration camps, the gulag. Any deviation from the party line was viewed as a threat to public life. I remember reading one communist intellectual in the 1930s saying that if the party tells me that white is black, then I will say white is black. And if the party says black is white, I will trust the party and say that black is white. That kind of extensive self-policing. And this is indeed a version of what I found when I lived in East Germany, in East Berlin in 1984 to 85. I was at a Protestant seminary, and that gave the students a little bit of a free space, but they were constantly aware, constantly concerned that their mail was being read and censored, that if they made a telephone call, somebody was listening, that the state officials were able to penetrate even into people's private spheres, into their kitchens and bedrooms to monitor what they were saying and thinking. So how do you live as a Christian under that kind of regime? The concentration camps that typified both Nazi Germany and Stalinist Russia. Well, now we've moved away from the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century, but the years I've spent in Russia have been under the rule of this man, Vladimir Putin. And Putin's regime is not a totalitarian one, but it's authoritarian. And I'd like to say a word about the difference. What Vladimir Putin has done, in distinction from the totalitarian regimes, is to allow people a free space privately. The secret police in Russia are not monitoring what people say in their kitchens or in their bedrooms. They're not asking people to quit thinking in their own private sphere, but they're not supposed to speak out publicly. They're not supposed to organize a public opposition. And what Putin has done is to make a deal with the population. You can have your private sphere, and the state will provide relative economic security in exchange for passivity. Public opposition is carefully controlled and restricted in Russia. You can think whatever you want at home, but in public, you enjoy the good life, but you never say anything against the government. So if you were to go to Moscow today, you would see a great deal of economic prosperity, but very few people who would ever be willing to participate in a political opposition party or in a political demonstration against the government. Some of you, I'm sure, have read about this man, Alexei Navalny. He is one of the few people in Russia who has organized a political opposition. And a number of months ago, he was poisoned. And there's strong evidence that the Russian security forces are behind this poisoning. He was airlifted to Germany, where he was in a coma for several weeks, is finally on his way to recovery. But this is a typical story. The authoritarianism of the Putin regime has been highly effective at eliminating any kind of organized political opposition. And Navalny would be fine if he would keep his opinions to himself. He would be fine if he said what he wanted to say among his friends. But as soon as people like this go into public and try to get organized, the authoritarian regime crushes it. So again, as I have experienced both kinds of regimes, the totalitarianism of communism in East Germany and the authoritarianism of Vladimir Putin in Russia today, I've thought a lot about what does it mean to be a Christian under those circumstances? What are the options available? And again, as I said earlier, typically we think, well, there are only two options. It's either to become an Alexei Navalny and to take the consequences, in his case, of being poisoned almost to death, or to be simply passive, to withdraw, to go along with the regime, to go along, even if you don't really agree with it, to learn the language, to accommodate oneself, to half believe, if not fully believe, in what the regime is saying. And I'm trying to think about an option in between, because I think it's the option that Jesus shows. It's the option that characterizes his life, especially when we look at the passion narratives, when we look in the Gospels at the way that he is arrested, the way he deals with the religious and political authorities. Three things again at stake. Truth-telling, because in authoritarian regimes, the state wants to control the public narrative of what is true or false. So a Christian under those circumstances is called to remain committed to the truth when the regime wants to control the truth. Caring. Reaching out for others, because the effect of totalitarian authoritarian regimes is to fragment society, to make them want to withdraw into their own private sphere so that people look out only for themselves. They're afraid to interact with others. They are distrustful of relationships with other people, not knowing whether others are going to betray them. So to care for others, to reach out to others, is a political act, I believe, under the conditions of an authoritarian government. And the third virtue that we're interested in is that of dignity. How is it that when the state tries to crush people's freedom, when it tries to take away self-determination, replace it with the party ideology, how is it that maintaining one's dignity is also an act of political opposition? In this quiet way of the way one conducts one's life, the quiet virtues, the quiet politics of Jesus. So let's think for a moment about Jesus and those last days of his life. This is a painting by a Russian artist, Nikolai Gie. Jesus before Pilate. And we immediately can see that Jesus himself was living under an authoritarian regime that has parallels to Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia or even Putin's Russia today. Jesus faced the authoritarianism of first of all, the religious authorities, and the religious authorities were anxious to control the Jewish population because the religious authorities themselves were under the thumb of the political authorities. And then the political authorities, who were always afraid of an insurrection and wanted to carefully control the population that they were exploiting. So here we have Jesus living under an authoritarian regime. We wonder about where Jesus would be in Nazi Germany, where Jesus would be in the Communist Soviet Union, where Jesus would be in other authoritarian regimes today. And what we notice about the way Jesus interacts with Pilate is that he's actually very quiet. We read the gospel accounts today, what is so striking is that Jesus actually has very little to say. When Pilate says, "Are you king of the Jews?" You recall that Jesus responds, "Well, you have said so." When the high priest accuses him of calling himself the Son of God, again, Jesus responds in a very quiet way. Jesus is quietly responding, saying, again, "You have said so." So we see that Jesus is living his protest not by openly demonstrating against Pilate, but neither is he passively withdrawing. And both of these options were not entirely popular among some of his followers. We remember that among Jesus's followers were some who called themselves zealots. And they wanted Jesus to practice open protest. They wanted Jesus to start a revolutionary movement. And they were disappointed that he declined to do so. You remember the scene in the Garden of Gethsemane where some of Jesus's followers came out with swords and the ear of the high priest was cut off. And Jesus says, "Put your sword away." So the way of open political protest is not one that Jesus takes. But those who wanted him passively to withdraw were also disappointed. You remember some of his disciples said, "Don't go up to Jerusalem. That's where you will be arrested and executed." They were opposed to Jesus, even in his quiet way, offering opposition to the authoritarian regime. So this third way that Jesus takes is characterized by his insistence that he's going to continue to tell the truth. He will tell the truth to Pilate. He's committed throughout his life to reaching out to those who are suffering and in need. He's not going to allow an authoritarian regime to drive him into passivity and fearfulness. And he maintains his dignity. One of the remarkable things about the way that he encounters Pilate is that he has this fearlessness that even the powerful cannot break Jesus's spirit. They cannot break his sense of inner freedom. Well, finally, this last slide where we have, again, a painting of Jesus being betrayed in the garden. Even his quiet politics does not save him from the ire of the authoritarian regime. But he goes about it in such a different way than that from which we often think about politics. We're thankful that we live in a democracy, and whatever its weaknesses and fractures, we still have considerable space for organized political opposition. We can form opposition parties, we can have demonstrations and public protests. We can have the elections where there's fierce competition for votes. All of this is possible still for us. But I'm hoping that as we go through this series, we will also think about this third form of politics and what that might mean for us. How might we in our lives, in the way that we live, cultivate those three virtues that we see with Jesus? How can we learn to remain committed to truth, to caring for others, and to maintaining, preserving our own inner freedom, our own dignity, as we try to live out faithfully the Christian life? All right, so let me stop there and see if there are questions. And I'm not quite sure, Ted, I'm getting a message on my machine about someone wanting remote control of the screen. Do I approve that? Do I decline it? I'm not quite sure what that message means. Do you know?
I think that was probably a mistake, but there is a question from John Hayes asking, is truth-telling prophetic?
Is truth being truth-telling prophetic? Well, John, maybe you can tell me a little bit more what you're thinking when you say the word prophetic. Can you add a little bit to your question?
Yes, when I made my comment, it was before I really thought about it that much. So I'm thinking of the prophets as truth-telling, truth to power sort of thing. But in the totalitarian or authoritarian system, I gather the truth to power is not very good idea, nor what Jesus did with Pilate. He limited what he had to say. But I think, I guess my question, I'll put it to you. I'm not going to try to answer it. Where is prophecy? I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, well, I think it is the characteristic of authoritarian regimes that, at least in public, they want everyone to toe the party line, that there is not room for any truth beyond the truth that the party determines. And that, of course, is not really truth. It's an ideology. It's a way of interpreting the world that guarantees the power of one small group over the rest of society. So in that way, truth-telling is always threatening to power. Truth-telling in the sense of looking through and beyond the official ideology. When I lived among the students in East Germany in the 1980s, there was no clear place to find truth about social political circumstances. All the newspapers were controlled by the Communist Party. All of the television stations. You had to find alternative sources for understanding what was really happening. And people became very creative in their efforts to find and tell the truth. So one example would be, there was a lot of environmental devastation in Eastern Germany as the Communist Party promoted heavy industry, and that industrialization led to terrible pollution problems and environmental destruction. There were Christians who quietly, with scientific expertise, began to measure air quality. They began to measure chemicals in the soil and to form small networks where they could disseminate this information. So that was their effort to remain committed to the truth, when it would have been a lot easier just to passively go along and not worry about all of that, just think that the best you were going to do was to passively withdraw. But in their own quiet way, they had this commitment to truth-telling. That is threatening. That is threatening to a government that wants to control the narrative in order to maintain its own power.
So I have a question. I am reminded of the metaphor of a tree falling in the forest and when no one is around, and the question that it raises is, does it make any sound if no one hears it? And so I just wonder at what point you are quietly telling the truth so quietly that it is not heard.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that that is a great question. And of course, under an authoritarian regime, it's a very controverted question, because those who practice the quiet politics that I'm talking about may be seen as not courageous enough, not bold enough. You know, there will always be some who say, you ought to openly protest and take the consequences. And that certainly is an important form of witness under an authoritarian regime, that there are people who are willing to make that open protest and take the consequences. So I don't want to discount that as a viable option, perhaps in some circumstances, the most faithful option. But I think that, as I was saying, I think political scientists have tended to ignore these quieter forms of protest that, in their own way, I think are equally faithful and perhaps in the end even more effective. Because when you go public, the government knows how to get rid of you. But governments always are more tormented by what to do with the quiet protesters like Jesus. Now, it's true that he ends up on the cross, I guess, in the same way that someone practicing open political protest could have ended up on a cross. But it's with a much guiltier conscience. There is this sense that the truth-telling that Jesus practices will not be eliminated simply by crucifying him, that this demonstrates some capacity in the human spirit to remain alive and to continue to question and to search, even when an authoritarian government would prefer that that not take place. But yeah, it's a great question. You know, when is quiet politics itself too passive, and when is open political protest a vain gesture that misses the realities of the regime under which one finds oneself?
So I know John, Bob Dilley has a question, but I'll just amplify what you said about being more effective and offer the thought that sometimes it's more effective to give people the dots and let them connect them than to tell people what they should conclude. Because when a person draws their own conclusion from simple facts, it's much more powerful and much more difficult to dissuade them from their conclusions. Bob, did you have a question?
Yeah, I want to play a little bit, if you'll indulge me, with this notion of authoritarianism. As many people on this call know, I'm involved in anti-racism, particularly over the last couple of years. And I'm struck, I'm looking at a definition, and it's pretty much what you gave, John. And I'm thinking about protecting the status quo. So, you know, in some ways, you know, looking at systemic racism and how deeply embedded it is in our culture and politics and even our political system, some of the attributes seem to overlap this notion of authoritarianism. Does that make sense, or is that a stretch too far?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think that even in our democracies in the West that we are so proud of, when we compare them to totalitarianisms, absolutely, there are totalizing instincts, there are totalizing impulses in every society. There are always people with power who want to create structures that force others into passive submission. So no, I think you're really onto something. I think that, again, we have in theory, in principle, we have certain political options to us under a democracy that are not present in authoritarian regimes. But I think you're absolutely right that nevertheless, there are these totalizing impulses, and structural racism might be one good example of where, again, there is a particular structure that is undermining, it's violating the ability to remain committed to truth, to care for those beyond our small circle, and to ensure that people can preserve their personal dignity. And I think, you know, it would be very interesting to see how people who have suffered under racism and structural racism, the different kinds of political options that they have turned to. So, you know, there's a great deal in Martin Luther King that I think would follow along the lines of what I'm talking about, that King felt a great deal of political protest had to begin with the condition of one's own heart, that if one practiced open protest in a way that violated the oppressor, that really society was just replacing one form of violence with another. And so I think he's an example of someone who argued very much for these quiet politics of Jesus, at least as a precondition for moving into open political opposition, that there needs to be a Christian capacity to practice truth-telling, caring, and dignity if open political protest is to be done in a way that moves us closer to the peaceable kingdom rather than to new forms of political violence and competition.
I have a comment. I'm Bobby Hartman. I had a pastor once who said the Christian life is like breathing. You have to breathe in and you have to breathe out. And if you stop doing either one, you'll die. And so as you were talking about Martin Luther King, I'm just working on John Meacham's book about John Lewis, and there's a great deal in it about the internal life and how important that is. But it always comes down to the fact, or at least I think it does, that there are things that need to change. And whether we're talking about, I'm involved somewhat with Bob on the anti-racism question, if we want to talk about income inequality, if we want to talk about difficulties in distribution of education or housing or any of those things, there are inequities and there are things that need to change. And the problem is that the people in charge are the ones who benefit from the way things are. So that is there any way to avoid a challenge to that? So I don't know, unless it is what maybe what you're saying is this quiet politics convicts somehow just by its existence, and people see that and say, oh, I need to change. But that requires an internal work. So
right. No, I think you're, thank you, Bobby. And that, you know, helps me think a little bit more too about these points. So I think that what Jesus is pointing to is very much the condition of the heart, that opposition politics will go awry unless we have done that inner work first of freeing ourselves from the dominant ideologies that are controlling us. And I think this really is the way, in fact, that change took place in communist countries, in East Germany. What really happened was that people began that process of inner freedom, and that's what finally gave them, that spread far enough that it could turn into a viable political movement. It was no longer just one or two protesters who openly expressed their opposition and then were arrested and crushed. But this change in heart, there was something infectious about it. It began to move enough people that then a viable political movement could be built out of it. So I'm very interested in this question, the breathing in, the inner work that takes place for Christians, and the breathing out, how that then expresses itself. Now, of course, the case of Nazi Germany is different. There, it was only from the outside that the oppressive structures could be destroyed. There was not, there were people like Bonhoeffer and Niemöller and others who cultivated a different kind of inner spirit, but it never spread far enough within the German people for it ever to turn into a viable political movement. So there, you know, yes, history takes different shapes, different solutions here. And what happened in Germany had to come from the outside, whereas in Eastern Europe, it came from, I think, this inner transformation that I'm calling the quiet politics of Jesus. And I think is what would have to happen in many authoritarian regimes today that are very skillful about trading off people's passivity for guaranteeing them some measure of economic security, which I think, you know, we could say is also probably a problem in our society, that a lot of people are content to be fairly passive politically as long as their own personal standard of living is okay.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
John, there's a question from Nana Wilson. Is it not correct that the seminary in East Berlin would have been closed as Bonhoeffer's seminaries were closed by the Nazis if there had been open protest? Is that not true?
That is true, of course. I mean, that's why, you know, the best they could do was sort of this quiet way of trying to cultivate a different ethos in the midst of a totalitarian regime. No, you're absolutely right. Open protest, if that had become a center for a opposition political movement, it would have been closed down. It would have been eliminated. And so, you know, there's a kind of practicality here that you're pointing to, Nana. You know, Jesus in the end goes to the cross, and in the end there were people who went to prison for their quiet politics in communist East Germany. But it also, they were skillful at carving out an alternative space in which they could touch other people's lives. And so that's what's interesting to me, this kind of practical strategy for a kind of quiet, underground, if you will, way of disseminating a different way of looking at the world that's not immediately crushed, not immediately eliminated as a political possibility by an authoritarian regime. Okay, well, next week, so the next 3 weeks, we're going to look each week at one of these virtues that I've been talking about. So next week, we will look at truth-telling, followed by the next 2 weeks with reaching out, caring, and preserving one's personal dignity. Anything else, Ted? Are we at our time or do we keep going here?
I think we're at our time, and I would just like to say thank you very much. This has been given us so much to think about, so much to think about. Thank you so much.
I look forward to, I don't exactly see you, but I look forward to seeing you next week and look forward to continuing our conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome.